Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and is it that time of the week again? Yes, it is. It is time for Q&A with Layla. Layla Mutin is Hoffman Center nutritionist. She's a registered dietitian, and she holds a master's degree in nutrition, and she frequently accompanies me when I endeavor to answer listener questions. And if you may be mystified about how to get your questions to us, radioprogram@AOL.com, radioprogram@AOL.com, will enable you to pose your questions. Actually, some of them we garner from other sources, from my Facebook page, occasionally from Twitter. We have a variety of ways of gleaning fodder for our Q&A sessions each week. So welcome to the program, Layla. It's nice having you.
Hi, Dr. Hoffman. Thank you.
So do you have anything, before we get to questions, anything on the top of your agenda this week?
Just gearing up, I suppose, for the Thanksgiving holiday. Do you believe it's November?
It's unbelievable. It's just accelerating.
Here we go again.
Of course, this year we have the unusual convergence of Hanukkah and Thanksgiving, which they say, I read somewhere that the next time this will occur is in 8,700 years, or is 87,000?
Wow!
Years, I'm not sure. Yeah. So.
Wow!
So that's a unusual kind of thing.
Yeah. I certainly don't remember anything like that in my lifetime. Yeah.
There's a big controversy because some people are for this. They say this is great, a traditional American holiday, blended with a religious holiday. What a great opportunity for cross fertilization, and we can have turkey stuffed with matzo balls. And other people say, more conservative persuasion are saying that this is some form of religious desecration. Let's maintain the holiday as it is, and let's not
really?
Messages. Yeah, there's actually a backlash against Thanksgivica backlash.
Thanksgivica.
So I'm sure that that there will be a very earnest disputation in religious and patriotic circles about whether to blend the holidays or mix them. I'll leave that to the argumentative types.
Right.
So
in the meantime, everybody enjoy whatever it is you choose.
Whatever floats your boat. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So what I want to bring up, though, before we get to questions, I know we have a lot of them, is that to my surprise and disappointment, the election, a lot of people focused on the gubernatorial races, mm-hmm. Terry McAuliffe and Ken Cuccinelli in Virginia. And,
yes. That was a big upset, yeah.
Well, that was expected. McAuliffe was supposed to win. What was an upset was that Cuccinelli did a little better than they thought. No, I think that was actually a predicted result. And then Christie versus non-entity, I forget her name, mm-hmm. in New Jersey. But the disappointing result was from Washington State. And what happened is the yet another GMO initiative, an initiative to label GMOs, was defeated.
Unbelievable.
It's believable in part because the food industry funneled $22 million into a campaign.
Money buys everything, apparently.
Yeah.
If you have enough money, you could do anything you want.
So it's follow.
Including all of that. Well, that's unfortunate.
Yeah, and if you look at the political campaigns also, you follow the money trail too, because the more well-financed campaigners did prevail in the races in question. So, clearly there's a money element. I'm planning to talk to someone on tomorrow's podcast. I'm going to talk to Daryl Rogers of the Alliance for Natural Health.
And wonderful.
We'll be talking about the GMO initiative and why it failed, and we'll be talking about other political issues that are of importance to our intelligent medicine fans.
Yeah.
So do you have any questions from our listeners?
Actually, yes. This is from John, and it's for you, Dr. Hoffman. John says, Doc, what type, brand, or source of decaf coffee do you drink all day?
Okay. What I do and what I advocate are disconnected. I happen to have, why did you ask me that question?
It's okay. There's nothing wrong with decaf coffee.
Full disclosure. So here's the deal. First of all, Let's get into this, the overall coffee debate. You know, for many years we were telling people that coffee is bad for you. And so some people abandoned coffee, some people went to decaf as a preferable alternative. Actually, some studies are suggesting that for the vast majority of people, caffeine is well tolerated, and caffeine may have some benefits. It may actually help to fend off depression, it improves alertness and cognitive abilities. We all know that, you know, we get that buzz from caffeine. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, it's well tolerated. Some studies have suggested that it might increase heart problems. The latest studies vindicate it because, you know, people are concerned that it might cause a dangerous heart arrhythmia if you get too much caffeine. I guess if you overdose on caffeine, maybe.
Look, you can overdose on anything.
Anything.
You can overdose on green apples.
Right.
I mean, it's all. I love a cup of high test in the morning.
There you go.
You know.
Right.
There you go. Maybe a cup of decaf after dinner. There's nothing wrong with coffee.
Yeah. And then there's also the beneficial polyphenols that you get whether you get the caffeinated or decaffeinated version, the stuff that makes coffee dark. It's actually rich in anti-cancer mm-hmm. substances, so wonderful antioxidants, polyphenols that are similar to those found in tea and in red mm-hmm. wine, resveratrol, and so on. So there's a lot of benefits. Now, so the question is, you know, what do I drink? And I like, unfortunately, I gravitate towards Starbucks decaf. And this is mostly a matter of taste. But these days, you know, every time I poke my nose into a Starbucks, I see the lines of people waiting, and I go, this is not right. You know, to, like, wait in line for 10 or 15 minutes for a cup of coffee? That's nuts. So I'm sort of now getting away from patronizing Starbucks. I really got to do something about that.
I heard they're going to be opening up tea cafes, by the way.
Oh, wow.
Teavana. I think they just bought the Teavana chain. I didn't even know it was a chain.
Wow.
But I was at my local mall over the weekend, and they had this beautiful, beautiful tea place, and the aroma of tea, to me, is just perfume, especially a good cup of Earl Grey. And apparently Starbucks bought Teavana. You may see more tea houses around now. Now, that's a place I would go and hang out.
Yeah, no, that is
with my laptop.
If you can't meet them, join them. You know,
right.
and you know, it's kind of like if you're in competition, just buy the competition. You know, for people who don't like coffee, okay, we'll just buy you. But look, they're a well-organized company. They know how to get it done, and they know how to negotiate the leases and so on. So, you know, more power to them. So here's a problem, though, with decaffeination. And there is this notion that in order to decaffeinate coffee, you have to subject it to harsh chemical processing. And one of the dangerous chemicals that's used in chemical processing is something called methylene chloride. That's not a very happy chemical. I think it's used a little in the dry cleaning business, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
And so what most people think is the preferable type of decaffeinated coffee is something called water-processed decaffeinated coffee, where somehow they use a high-temperature water extraction method to get the caffeine out. I'm not sure what the chemistry of that is.
I think that's the same as the Swiss process. I think it kind of started there. I may be wrong, but yeah.
And I used to scrupulously seek out a place that offered that. And it was expensive, but I thought it was worth it because who needs to drink the additional chemicals when you're drinking decaf?
Sure.
So maybe we could do a little due diligence on this subject and scope it out, and maybe and certainly, you know, when you advise patients at the Hoffman Center, maybe you can give them the preferable options, because we do not have a, you know, kind of a old line nutrition. You know, you see the nutritionist, you know, this crabby, you know, nutritionist, and the nutritionist says, you know, you got to stop drinking coffee. First thing, stop drinking alcohol, stop drinking coffee. And, you know, we actually try to tailor our programs to people's concerns. I mean, if you have terrible GERD, okay, maybe coffee's not the best thing for you.
Well, there's an alternative, Dr. Hoffman.
Okay.
There's something called Kava, K-A-V-A. It's instant coffee, but it's low, low acid. I actually tried it. It's completely smooth. It's quite delightful. And I've been recommending it for my patients who are diehard coffee drinkers. You know, people don't want to give it up. And if there's a substitute, why not?
Indeed. So
why not?
So it's doable. But so the point being is that, you know, if we advise people about decaf, you know, maybe we can just make sure that the decaf that we're recommending is not chemically processed. I regret to say that I'm not as careful as I need to be in my selection of decaf.
Oh, you're careful enough.
Careful enough. Thank you.
The other thing, of course, for everybody, you know, we want to buy organic coffee as well, organic teas. We want to
yes.
be able to seek those out as well because, you know, we still have to, just like with our produce, we have to worry about pesticide, herbicide, all of that kind of stuff.
Very good.
Hopefully there won't be any GMO coffee, but that remains.
Well, you know, what may happen is they may cross a coffee bean with a cow, and then you'll be able to get café au lait from the udder of the cow. I think that, you know, just wait.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You may get something there.
That's next. Okay. Next question.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Good afternoon. This is from, I love the way this is from Kathleen.
Right.
And she calls herself Confounded Kate.
Okay.
Can you tell me why the glands under my jaw often get sore when my allergies are bad? Currently, mold from leaves, pumpkins, etc. is very high and my glands are sore.
Mm-hmm.
What's the connection and what can I do to alleviate the soreness?
Well, you know, that's really an interesting question because, you know, I have to say that allergy doesn't always prompt swollen glands.
Yeah.
But a severe allergy might prompt swollen glands. And, you know, usually we think of swollen glands being due to an infection of some kind. Mm-hmm. You know, if you get, you know, sometimes an infection, you might see a swollen gland pop up under your ear or in the angle of your jaw. And that indicates an infection. After all, you know, mononucleosis is a perfect example of that. Its old name is glandular fever. And you get very, very big swollen glands under your jawbone, and that would be a sign that you had mononucleosis in the old days. So, you know, a viral infection will cause that. In this case, I don't suspect that our friend Confounded Kate is suffering from a viral infection. I think that this is an example of how allergies that appear to be just external, you know, we think they just involve the eyes, the nose, the throat, or the lungs, it's systemic. It's going literally into her system, in her bloodstream. And so when people, during allergy season, some people who suffer from allergies, they don't just get stuffy nose. They just experience malaise and fatigue,
yeah.
bodily aches and pains. And they get, they have a whole systemic reaction. Their whole body, their whole immune system goes into overdrive. And they feel really bent out of shape.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, is there any other reason that these glands could be swollen? I mean, you know, she should certainly get anything ruled out by an ENT or,
yeah.
or her
physician.
Yeah, I mean,
physician. Look, I mean, this is the rule of thumb. I mean, because, you know, a lot of people come to me and they say, could you feel this thing here? And is this dangerous? And, you know, they'll point to a little swollen gland. And it's normal to be able to feel those little, like a little pea-sized gland, you know, under your ear or beneath the angle of your jaw. And that's not necessarily a sign of anything dangerous, but if it keeps enlarging, I mean, it's okay if it waxes and wanes in size. That means that it's subject to, you know, some externality, like, you know, your immune system kind of kicking in and then relaxing after a challenge. But if it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger, that's when you have to be concerned that it could be a sign of a tumor or even, you know, something like lymphoma. It's a swollen gland type of cancer. And then you have to get a biopsy. Usually even before a biopsy, doctors will look at a swollen gland. They'll say, look, we'll give you a dose of antibiotics for a week or so. And if it goes away, it's fine. But if it doesn't go away, that's a concern. Or, you know, you can get MRIs, CAT scans to see if there's, you know, more to just the surface manifestations of the gland. If there's something, if it's larger, if there's something internal, you know, if it looks suspicious, then you have to take a biopsy and see what it is. So.
Yeah.
So, you know, but I think what she's experiencing is the systemic effects of her bad allergies. I mean, she reports that they come and they go regularly with the allergy season.
Wow. Wow. And, you know, the symptoms often are, they're not always, you know, nasal, sinus congestion, throat, anything like that. It can be a general malaise.
Yes,
it can. And people don't connect the two.
They don't connect.
And it's important.
And this is actually,
consider,
you know,
that.
I think this is one of the reasons that people are really thrown for a loop with the season change, because usually allergies are worse in spring and fall, and there's a temperature change. There's certainly a change in sometimes in the pace of life. You know, after a long, consistent summer or after a long winter where you're sort of holed up and then everything changes. But also there's a change in the level of allergy And that may throw the body into disarray. I mean, there's actually studies that show that people with certain diseases like ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, which are immune diseases, they tend to flare in when the season changes. And other diseases act like that, too.
Yeah. Excellent points. Okay. We have another question. And this is somebody who got our Intelligent Medicine newsletter, reading about the top 10 supplements for immune support.
Okay.
This flu season.
Heads up on that. Yeah. They already have a question? Because that just went out yesterday.
Yeah. Okay. We already have a question.
Okay.
Like two and a half hours after it went out, we have a question.
Okay.
And this person, I don't have their name on this email that I'm reading, but they're asking 55,000 IU vitamin D daily for 3 days for immune support. And they say, I take 5,000 per day now, and I thought that was too much, but my doctor says it isn't. First of all, hats off to your doctor who says 5,000 a day is not too much,
right?
Because there are still too many doctors out there saying, oh, no, that's too much. Don't take more than 1,000.
Right. And by the way,
that's not
for everyone. You know, there's some.
It's not. It's not for everyone.
Right. But, you know, many of our patients require that much to optimize their vitamin D levels. It's a matter of testing to see what the level should be.
Exactly. And optimal testing is twice a year, once after summer, once after winter. That's really the only intelligent way to figure out how to dose our patients at all.
Indeed.
Is to check what their levels are first. Talk about in the article, if I may mention, Dr. Hoffman, is that the Vitamin D Council, Dr. Cannell, even says, and we've been advising our patients the same thing, if they ever feel like they're coming down with a cold or a flu, taking 50,000 IU of vitamin D3 daily for three consecutive days is very helpful. I know I've done that on many occasions, and it's knocked the cold right out for me, or at least shortened the duration.
Right. No, I think that no question that can be beneficial. And it, from the research, it seems to work better with flus than with colds. And my experience with this is that it doesn't make you completely bulletproof, but it will shorten the duration and severity of whatever you're coming down with. So at the first sign of a flu-like illness, and you can do this for a cold, but it's not going to be as 100% with the cold. And Dr. Cannell agrees. I mean, the reason he believes this is that originally he was a psychiatrist, and he was assigned to monitor patients in a psychiatric ward in a hospital. And what he did is he was interested in nutrition, and he said, look, I'm going to dose patients with high-dose vitamin D. And I don't think it was even such high dose. I think it was like 2,000 a day. But in those days, that was considered high dose. One group of patients was going to get this relatively high dose of vitamin D, and another group was not protected. And when flu season rolled around, there was usually a big epidemic of flu in the hospital at that time. And what he found was there was a dramatic difference, and these patients were the same, except for the fact they took vitamin D. There was a dramatic reduction in the flu in the patients who took vitamin D. So this is a classic experiment where he discovered the efficacy of vitamin D for the immune system. And now he publishes the Vitamin D Council newsletter.
Yeah, excellent newsletter for anybody who wants to read vitamindcouncil.org.
And by the way, our newsletter, it's a radio program at AOL.com as well. Just state, you know, if you don't have a question but you just want the newsletter, great source of information, comes out weekly. Layla and I collaborate on that. My latest article is on natural supplements for cold and flu season. And you can get that by emailing us to radioprogram@AOL.com and just request the newsletter.
Yep. You got any questions?
Do I have any questions?
Yeah.
You have a list, or I can look at questions.
I've got one ready here.
Go.
This is a tough one. This is from Alan.
Right.
Are there any dietary connections with retinal detachments?
Yes.
You
know, funny, Alan is my Facebook friend,
mm-hmm.
and he is an inveterate listener. A shout out to Alan. Alan, you know who you are. Alan and I went to high school together.
Oh my goodness.
The history is, and Alan will recount this, we weren't friends, we just knew each other. And I remember Alan from junior high school. We both were in Santa Monica, California. We went to Lincoln Junior High School. And this was in the day where I was an inveterate egghead. I hadn't yet embarked on my athletic career, which I only began in my 20s. And I just hated exercise. But Alan, and I'm sure Alan would acknowledge this, Alan was what we could term a running fool. he was a guy who enjoyed running and endurance athletics at the age of, he must have been 13 or 14 years old. And so, you know, when the coach, told, you know, we did something, we're goofing off or something, the coach would say to me, run a lap. And it was all of a quarter mile. It was no big deal. I would think, oh my God, this is the most draconian punishment imaginable. But when they would say to Alan, run a lap, he would just gladly light out and come back with a big smile on his face and ask the coach if he could run another lap. But now Alan has resettled on the East Coast. He lives in Connecticut. He's an inveterate cyclist. He's a big bicycler. He's sort of, you know, not, he's concentrating on that as his main aerobic activity. We're about the same age. And Alan's a big fan of Health Talk and the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. So we want to answer his question on the air. And his question is, go ahead.
Are there dietary connections with retinal detachments? He says, I just got informed I have one and have to have surgery for it at Yale this week. Talk about an unexpected bombshell being dropped.
Right.
Excellent health, no family history, fairly good diet, no eye trauma ever. Only possible link might be cataract surgery 10 years ago.
That's interesting. Okay, so here's the deal. When it comes to retinal detachments, first of all, what is a retinal detachment? Well, the retina is sort of like a screen of highly light-sensitive cells that's at the back of the eyeball. And light passes through the lens of the eye and through the, you know, initially through the pupil and then through the cornea, then through the pupil and then through the lens of the eye. And then it's projected against this screen called the retina in the back. And the retina translates light images into neurochemical electric impulses that then go to the brain, and then the image is reconstructed in the brain. It's quite remarkable. So what happens with the retina is that sometimes the retina comes loose from the inner surface of the eyeball. And when it does so in a way that can interfere with vision, it's called a retinal detachment. Actually, some cases of floaters may represent cases of a little minor tugging on the retina, or the retina is slightly displaced, doesn't require surgery. The surgery that's usually required is not knife, it's not like scalpel surgery, it's usually laser surgery. It's sort of like a spot weld, you know, with a laser, just like sort of tack down the loose end of the retina, sort of zap it with a light impulse. I think that's the kind of surgery that's being contemplated. This is something that typically occurs in people in middle age, and I do not believe that there is necessarily a nutritional correlate. The fact that he has had surgery already in the eye might mean that his eyeball was traumatized and something was disrupted, might have something to do with it, or might not. It might just be a coincidence. He's a young guy.
You know what?
Yeah, go ahead.
You know what? You could detach your retina from sneezing too hard,
yes.
I found out.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Oh, did you have a detached retina?
Well, no, I had a scare last May. I had a scare where I had floaters in my left eye that came out of nowhere, and the
like
seemingly lightning. Yeah, light.
Yeah.
And I kept turning around to see where the light was coming from. It was in my eyeball. So finally I went down to Iron Ear Infirmary,
right.
And they checked me out. They said, no, you're fine. These floaters should clear up. I don't know what happened. I'm like, I didn't fall down. I didn't hit my head. I'm not on medication.
And you're in superb health. And Layla, this is a typical scenario for, you know, and I'm going to be a little revealing about your demographic, over 35 women, okay?
I'll go for it. I'm going to be 50 my next birthday.
Okay.
Bring it on.
Full disclosure. So this is something that is not necessarily a sign of bodily deterioration or degeneration. It just seems to occur. And a little more female predominance than male. I don't believe there's necessarily a nutritional correlate to this at all. And I wish there was a nutritional way to prevent it. I can't say that there is. Maybe future research will reveal that. So, you know, Alan, unless you think that this is a merit system, I don't think it is. There is also a correlation between this type of retinal detachment and nearsightedness. I personally am nearsighted and was told long ago that I might be more prone to this. So far, let's see.
I'm nearsighted,
I'm knocking wood here.
Yeah, I'm nearsighted too.
Okay, so nearsighted people have a long eyeball. And a long eyeball, the shape of the eyeball makes it more likely that this will stretch or pull on the retina and make you more susceptible to retinal detachment.
Wow.
So whatever. So, you know,
What do we do? Stop reading? What do we do?
No, it's too late.
Only use our distance. It's too late. I know.
There are studies that show that in populations that have begun reading at a very early age, presumably you were an early reader that spent a lot of time reading, that creates a propensity to nearsightedness, you know, and that's nearsightedness, right? And myopia. But that's the price we pay for being, little advanced placement readers.
Yeah. Okay.
Which I guess you were too.
Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, I was told by my ophthalmologist that if I ever have that occur again, and this goes to anybody who's listening, the floaters that come out of nowhere, everybody has a normal amount of floaters, but this was extreme, and I started seeing light sparkling, or she told me, like a curtain coming down over your vision.
Yes.
She said, these are all medical emergencies, and you got to come back in.
Right. So, and, you know, I'll point out that usually this is a sign of a floater or, you know, retinal detachment, but it could also be a sign of a stroke. So if you have a vision cut, make sure that you just, you know, don't ignore it. Go to the emergency room, go to the eye and ear dispensary just to make sure that, or to your personal ophthalmologist as soon as you can, because it needs to be checked out, and it might be nothing or it might be something consequential.
Okay.
Next question. Let's see, what else do we have here? I have an interesting question. This is what's called a high-hanging curveball for you, Layla, that you can get out of the park, okay? Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. As a longtime devotee of Dr. Hoffman, I eat a healthful diet, high in protein and good fats, and very low in carbs. As a result, I'm healthy and not overweight. But I'm wondering if I've interpreted recent podcast comments correctly. I often hear Layla say that grains are carbs, too. I don't eat any junk food, but whole grains are a part of my diet, although a very small part. Based on Layla's comments and Dr. Perlmutter's book, Grain Brain, I'm wondering if I'm dooming myself to diabetes and Alzheimer's if I don't give up quinoa, flaxseed, and the other whole grains that I occasionally eat. Did I need to give up my once-per-week treat of a slice of multigrain bread that I used to really enjoy with my morning egg? Whole grains, good or bad, can you clarify?
Yes.
And by the way, she adds, thanks so much for the podcast. They're wonderful, and they're my constant exercise companion. So a very health-conscious individual. And
she's worried
that maybe she's, you know, falling short in her health regimen.
Well, listen, when she says, did I need to give up my once-per-week treat of a slice of a multigrain bread, you could do anything you want once a week as far as I'm concerned, unless you have a serious health condition that warrants otherwise. However, whole grains are not bad. However, if you have diabetes or pre-diabetes, if you're insulin resistant, you have to maintain the carbs to be under a certain amount per day. And it varies among individuals depending on how insulin resistant you are. If you're of a normal weight, you're exercising regularly, there is no insulin resistance, you have good fasting blood sugars, fasting insulins, hemoglobin A1C, and, you know, fasting blood sugar, now that I say it out loud, is not all we need to look at. In looking at all of that, if everything is fine, then you can have some grains on occasion. There's nothing wrong with that. And many can have a couple of servings a day. Whole grains are best. Many people do have a problem with gluten, however. And it's not all about celiac disease. There is a big gray area with many of the population that you and I see every day, Dr. Hoffman, of people having gluten sensitivity that needs to be addressed. So if you look at all these parameters and all of these are fine with her, then there's no reason she can't have her multigrain slice of bread, maybe even more than once a week if she desires it. So,
right. We don't want people to succumb to a condition which has been dubbed orthorexia nervosa, which is kind of a takeoff on anorexia. Anorexia means you don't want to eat anything or you're ultra concerned about calories. Orthorexia means that you're always concerned about the correctness of what you eat. Everything has to be perfect. And, you know, that sometimes gets to, A, it's a drag, and B, it gets people, you know, people lead stressful lives, you know, worrying about these things. You know, when it comes to the carbohydrates, I think everyone has a carb quotient, and it depends on your activity level, your genetics, your weight, and your medical history. And well, that's what we try to do, is we try to guide people to the correct degree of dietary adherence. For some of our patients, they do quite well on moderately high levels of carbohydrates. I have to include myself in that list. Although for some of my patients, it's essential that they very carefully manage their carbohydrates because that's their problem.
And we have another subset of patients who, once they have a slice of bread, whole grain or not, it flips on a switch the way it does for a sugar addict or an alcoholic or a drug addict. They could eat half the loaf. That's still part of carbohydrate addiction to some degree. Yeah.
I was just, I had a breakfast meeting with a friend, and he happens to be an attorney, and we were just discussing that. He said, I'm fine until I start lapsing into the, you know, carbohydrate dependency, and then I really am off to the races. So he says that as a strategy before Yom Kippur, you know, where you fast, you know, he's Jewish, he's observant on Yom Kippur, the week before he tapers his caffeine and he tapers his carbohydrates. He finds it's much easier to fast when he does that. Otherwise, he just is overcome with hunger pangs.
Yeah. Fasting is a good thing for like a whole day or something, just to reset the brain a little bit. It's best to get things under control. I'm not a big fan of fasting for several days in a row. That can be dangerous, and it shouldn't be done without supervision. But a day should be perfectly fine. I encourage everyone to drink plenty of water.
Okay, and that's actually a good that's a good segue to our next question, which is from Adobe Dweller is his name. Oh, his name is Ben. Okay. But his moniker, his handle is Adobe Dweller. He says, Dear Dr. Hoffman, I listen to your show here religiously here in Albuquerque. Now I understand why his moniker is Adobe Dweller, because nice Adobe architecture in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Follow you on Twitter and Facebook and subscribe to your newsletter. I had a question for you. Do you have an opinion on Willard Water? Thank you for your time. Signed, Ben. So I put it to you, Layla. Do you know anything about Willard Water?
Willard Water. Never heard of it.
Okay. Well, it reminds me of the horror movie called Willard, that's a movie about how the rats take over the world. It's called Willard.
Yeah.
Remember that movie where the rats are swarming over? You know? Okay. No, this has nothing to do with Willard. Willard Water is one of these kind of new age phenomena, which is the belief that some type of specially treated water is endowed with special healthful properties. Okay, and I'm just pulling up the website right now. Willard's Water. And here's what they say. And I, you know, think now because it's a website, I think they have to be a little bit chill in terms of the language they use for this. What do they say about it? They make all kinds of claims. It says it has the additional nutrients and minerals contained in fossilized remains of prehistoric vegetation. Well, I have to say that crude oil also contains the additional nutrients and minerals contained in fossilized remains of prehistoric vegetation. That's how we got. That's how we got the great oil deposits. You know, they call it that part of Texas is called the Jurassic part. You know, part of Texas. That great repository of. I don't know. The claim is that there are all these important nutrients in it. Let's see. I'm looking at what is Willard Water. They say it has unusual properties. It causes increased absorption of nutrients, increased elimination of toxins and waste. It's an exceptional scavenger of free radicals and an antioxidant. It reduces inflammation. It raises alkalinity. Yeah, I don't know. you know, I just...
Well, we could do all that with the food we eat and the supplements we take.
Thank you. And
I don't know.
And maybe just, you know, municipal water filtered through a Brita filter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's in my fridge. Okay.
Right. So let me just see how much this will set you back when you order it, because I want to look at the ordering section. It says, first of all, our prices, as you will see, are very competitive. But I can't see a price.
Huh.
It's priceless. Okay. It's kind of like the healthcare bill. You have to order one to see what's in it.
What a fiasco.
Okay.
Oh, my goodness.
Anyway. All right. So that's all the questions that I have.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I did have another question, which I didn't get to.
Uh-huh.
Which actually is a good setup for our upcoming lecture in January.
Oh,
that is a question of just recently, I think yesterday, a report was released, a study that shows that testosterone may be dangerous for men's hearts. And what they did is they looked at a bunch of men and they gave them testosterone. They found that they had a higher risk of heart problems when they took the testosterone. So, I'm not going to go into great detail with my critique of that study. We'll save it for our January seminar, which is going to be on andropause and menopause. Tell us about that, and I'll comment on the study.
Yes, and we're actually doing a duet on that. Both you and I are co-presenting. It's menopause and andropause. It's Wednesday, January 15, 6 p.m. You must make a reservation for your seat at 212-779-1744. And it's only a couple months away, believe it or not. We're in November. Wow.
Great. So we will cover such controversies as testosterone, good or bad for the heart, testosterone, good or bad for the prostate. What I'll say preliminarily is that the study in question is a little bit misleading. It's not easily generalizable to the average man who is given testosterone for the low T condition that we see so often advertised on TV. The men in this study were men who already had heart disease, or they had a demonstration of pretty severely blocked arteries. And what they found was a slightly increased risk of heart problems in these men. And it's a little bit like what happens when you give estrogen to an older woman who already has a high degree of arterial blockage. That's one of the problems with the Women's Health Initiative study, is that in that study, they found at first that it was bad for your heart. So on the basis of that study, tens of millions of women immediately cold turkeyed on their hormone replacement. They went through horrible hot flashes, but they were scared. They were scared off unnecessarily, because when they reanalyzed the same data from that study, and it took years before they looked at the data again and reanalyzed it, they found that women who took estrogen in the first few years past menopause, not women who took it started taking it when they were 65 or 70, that their hearts were protected from heart disease. So I think that that's probably going to be the case with men. And we may have to be a little careful with giving testosterone to men who have demonstrable heart disease or very serious heart problems. But we're going to examine that controversy in depth at the upcoming seminar. So we had a great turnout for our last seminar.
Yes.
And
yes.
That was on Alzheimer's Proof Your Brain. And we hope to have a nice lead time so we can get a nice audience for the January lecture. Let's hope there's not a blizzard. And that'll be in here. So we'll post information on that.
We're also going to talk about natural ways to increase testosterone, which a lot of people may be surprised, because
right.
So many of the drug ads for low T, you know, if you're fatigued and depressed, you know, maybe you need testosterone, but there are ways to naturally boost it for those who prefer not to take testosterone cream or anything like that. So we're
going
to get into all of that.
And we'll talk about natural ways to cope with menopause, non- mm-hmm. Pharmaceutically, you know, without dependence on hormones. If you have a bad breast cancer history, you're concerned about using hormone replacement therapy that's prescribed by a doctor. Although I do prescribe bioidentical hormones, and I think they're very beneficial, it's not for every woman. There are some natural ways to cope with menopause, and we'll talk about that, menopausal symptoms.
Yep.
Okay. Well, our work is cut out for us. We're going to get ready for that. I'm excited.
I'm excited, too. Mm-hmm.
All right. So until we meet again, well, that'll be tomorrow in the office.
Tomorrow.
But on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast, I believe you're scheduled again for next week. So we invite your questions, radioprogram@AOL.com. And might I mention that these podcasts are coming to you free and without commercial interruption. But here's a little bit of a commercial for drhoffman.com, where we offer you a wide variety of terrific supplements, supplements that we often mention in our podcasts and that we prescribe to our patients. They're available to you as a non-patient general audience. Just go to drhoffman.com and look under the store, and you'll see a wide array of very high-quality supplements. And lest you think that this is a very boutique-y website with prices that are inflated, we have a price match guarantee. Our products are very high quality, so they might be more in the higher echelon of prices, but we promise to match the price of any equivalent product that you might find anywhere else. So we want to stay in the competitive game price-wise and yet provide you with the highest quality supplements that we can. DrHoffman.com, click on the store. And this month we're featuring olive leaf extract. Can you say a couple of things on olive leaf extract?
Oh, olive leaf is wonderful for cold and flu season. It's a wonderful, potent antimicrobial. Guess what? It's also an antifungal. It can help to normalize blood pressure. It can also help stabilization of blood sugar. Olive leaf does a lot of good things. So, but especially during cold and flu season, I absolutely depend on it.
And actually, one of my favorite things, for, as you said, for treating candida or yeast infections, it really seems to work. Also, for adolescent acne, really can make a difference.
Yes.
There you go. All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us once
thank
again.
Thank you.
And I'll see you in the morning.
Okay.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.